Iran and the remaining signatories to the nuclear deal meet in Vienna for a new round of talks on reviving the international accord. A convoy of U.S. military troops comes under attack in southern Iraq. France threatens reprisals in the financial services sector if a deal agreed between the EU and Britain over post-Brexit fishing rights is not implemented. Greetings and a warm welcome to World News. Good to have you with us. Beginning with our top story, Iran and the remaining parties to the 2015 nuclear agreement have held fresh negotiations in Vienna, and that's aimed at reviving the embattled accord. Deputy Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi led the Iranian delegation in discussions with France, Germany, Britain, Russia, and China. This is the third round of talks since diplomatic efforts to salvage a deal began in early April. Speaking after the latest session, the Chinese envoy said that there has been significant progress in the talks, but major differences still remain. He stressed that the U.S. must remove its sanctions against Iran before Tehran returns to its compliance with the nuclear agreement.
We believe it is the U.S. previous administration who first pulled out from the JCPOA. So it's just axiomatic that U.S. should abolish all its unilateral sanctions against Iran, as well as any third party in the first place, before Iran move to implement the provisions on the JCPOA accordingly. So this is a fundamental issue involving rights versus wrong.
The official expressed hope that all parties could sustain the momentum already reached in order to settle the issues. The U.S. unilateral left the nuclear agreement in 2018 and imposed sanctions on Iran. Tehran began scaling back its commitments under the deal a year later in the face of the failure of other sides to ensure its benefits. Now, Tehran saying it will only reverse the commitment cuts once it verifies the removal of all sanctions imposed in the wake of the U.S. pullout. Tehran has also warned it will not continue talks if they become protracted. Let's go to Vienna, to the venue of these talks. We're just mentioning Huma Lezgi is there, and she's been there for quite some time. Huma, what do you have for us? What's the latest?
Okay, Behoud, we just had an interview with Iran's lead delegate, Mr. Abbas Araghchi, the deputy foreign minister who's leading the Iranian delegation here. And he did mention that ahead of the Joint Commission session, he had a meeting, one separate meeting with the Chinese and the Russians. And he said that during that meeting, it became clear that Russia and China share Iran's opinions and positions on almost all the issues that are up for discussions here. And he said he had a separate meeting with the three European countries, Britain, France, and Germany, and that various issues were discussed then. Then we had, of course, the Joint Commission session taking place between all the remaining signatories of the JCPOA, after which Mr. Araghchi said that the sides have agreed to start work on the third expert-level group. And this working group, he said, is called the Working Group on Practical Arrangements. That's how he termed it. And he said that this third working group will be working on not just the matter of sequence, meaning when the measures need to be taken both by Iran and the U.S. in order to come back to full compliance. It will also deal with the issue of verification, implementation day, and other practical arrangements that need to be made once there is a final agreement. Now, the issues here, he said, still remain. Although he said that he believes progress has been made and that the discussions are on the right track, he did also say that there are still some various important and serious challenges that need to be resolved, the most obvious one being the issue of sequence. He said that Iran's position is still the same, that it is not going to implement its measures, come back to full compliance before the U.S. has removed all the sanctions, and Iran has verified that removal. And he also said that obviously this is something that there are differences on, because we know the U.S. has said that it is also not going to do that, and it has also called for a compliance approach, something Iran rejects. And also, so this is one of the important issues, and also one of the important differences is the sanctions. So Mr. Araghchi, when I asked him what sanctions the U.S. is willing to lift and which sanctions the U.S. is not willing to lift, and if that's going to be a major problem or not, mm-hmm. he did say that Iran is still saying that it wants all of the sanctions removed. These include the sanctions that are part of the JCPOA and are JCPOA-related and need to be removed, and also the sanctions that have been introduced by the Trump administration. So he said basically all the sanctions that have been imposed under Trump after the Trump administration withdrew from the JCPOA in 2018. Right. Mm. So these are not just the JCPOA-related sanctions. These are sanctions that have been imposed on Iran under other labels like terrorism, human rights, etc., but do affect Iran's economy and the practical return to the JCPOA. So right now, he said that the sides are going to continue their negotiations immediately. The expert groups, he said, are going to continue their work, and the political directors are going to monitor that work and facilitate that process. We might see maybe within days another joint commission session, and then see where the sides will go from that stage on.
Okay, appreciate that. So, update on Maliski from Vienna. Now, a convoy of U.S. forces has reportedly come under attack in southern Iraq. Two improvised explosive devices went off on the route of the convoy in Diyarbakir province, that according to a security source. The two IEDs exploded remotely. The blast reportedly inflicted damage to one of the U.S. vehicles, which was carrying military equipment. Attacks on U.S. forces and their supply convoys in Iraq have risen in the past month as anti-American sentiments running high. The sentiments grew after the U.S. assassinated a top Iranian general and his senior Iraqi commander near Baghdad in January last year. A prominent international rights group says that Israel's persecution of Palestinians amounts to crimes against humanity and crimes of apartheid. Human Rights Watch says examples of the Israeli apartheid policies are the restrictions on Palestinians' movement, the seizure of their land for illegal settlements as well. The rights group has called on the International Criminal Court to investigate and prosecute Israeli officials over the persecution of the Palestinians. Several weeks ago, the court said it would investigate war crimes against the Israeli military in the occupied West Bank and the Gaza Strip. Mona Kendall in the occupied West Bank has provided us with some details about the latest report by Human Rights Watch.
They are accusing the Israeli authorities that they are allowing the Jewish settlers over Palestinians across the occupied territories. We are speaking about the West Bank, East Jerusalem, and even they are speaking about the besieged Gaza Strip. The aim is combined with the systematic oppression of the Palestinians and inhumane acts committed against them, which Human Rights Watch says taken together constitute the crime of apartheid. Let's elaborate what's the meaning of apartheid according to the international law. It's deemed as a crime against humanity by the Rome Statute, which established the International Criminal Court. The definition has many elements, mainly maintaining a group of people, domination by one racial group over another. So according to all the agreements, Palestinians must get these lands in order to establish their future Palestinian state. However, the Israeli authorities had brought those Jewish settlers to the mountains of the West Bank and in East Jerusalem. Al-Quds, they continue to attack Palestinians, assault them, seize their lands, ruin their properties. Every day, the Israeli authorities approve numerous laws against the law in order to protect and defend the Israeli settlers over the Palestinians while committing more crimes against the Palestinian people.
Russia has accused the U.S. and its NATO allies in Europe of contributing to an increased military threat in the region with their actions.
The growth of military threat is fueled by the activities of the United States and NATO in the European region. They increase the combat readiness of troops and strengthen their presence.
The Russian defense minister criticized NATO for deploying its modern military infrastructure and carrying out operational combat training in Europe. Shoigu also warned that nationalistic sentiments being fueled in Ukraine could further provoke military conflict in the Donbas region. He said that Moscow will act if it realizes necessary to ensure security at its borders. Tensions have run high between Russia and NATO countries following Moscow's military buildup along the border with Ukraine earlier this month. And that, of course, after reports of renewed clashes between Ukrainian troops and pro-Russia forces in Donbass. Ukraine, the U.S., and NATO accuse Moscow of propping up militia in eastern Ukraine, and that's what Moscow denies. Time now for the news review section. The European Parliament is set to ratify the post-Brexit trade deal between the bloc and the UK, and that's amid tensions, including a French threat of reprisals against Britain. According to reports, MEPs would approve the trade and cooperation agreement that has been operating provisionally since the UK officially left the EU in January. It covers trade in goods that can be free of tariffs or quotas. However, the vote comes amid multiple feuds over the UK's implementation of Brexit agreements. France accused the UK of blocking fishing rights, warning it would hold up approvals for British financial service operators to work in the EU. There are also tensions over the UK's unilateral decision to ease trading rules for Northern Ireland. Since Brexit, there has been some disruption to trade as Northern Ireland remains part of the EU's single market. Okay, let's see what's going on there. So we'll have a couple of our correspondents, people watching all these in Europe. We'll have our Kristen Honda from Paris and also Amina Taylor in our London bureau. Good to have both of you on the show. Now let's go to Paris first. Chris, what's this problem between France and the UK? Walk us through that and different aspects of it.
Well, it's a complicated agreement, this Brexit agreement. So it's like, in general, if it's implemented totally, it's favorable for France on the fishing, and it's favorable for the UK on the financial services. Now, France says it will only vote in favor of the full implementation of this agreement if the UK commits to its commitments. So it means the problem with the fishery thing is the French fisher boats should have authorization to fish in the UK waters because there is a lack of fish in the French area. So, and they say that only very few boats received the license of the UK to fish in the in the British waters. So they threaten to take reprisals, sanctions against UK on the financial services. What does that mean? When the when the United Kingdom was part of the European Union, there was free traffic of goods. It means no limitations on goods coming in the European Union out or out from the UK. Now, if the UK goes out of the European Union, it means that there will be quality checks on goods, and there will be there might be taxes to be paid on the goods if it comes in from the UK to the European Union. So the UK negotiated a favorable agreement on this issue, but France is threatening the UK if the UK does not respect the agreement on the fishing, then France will take reprisals on the financial services.
Okay. Now turning to London, Amina, good to have you with us. Hopefully you're safe from this COVID pandemic. There's the Indian version that's worse than what you're facing there in the UK. Now, regarding this UK's implementation of Brexit agreements, that seems to be the problem. Tell us about that and also the state of the UK fishing after the Brexit.
Well, let's clarify something Chris mentioned there, that whilst goods, as in physical goods, are covered by this agreement, the TCA, services and what that means for the service sector, banking, finance, student exchange, that kind of thing, that hasn't been fully covered yet. So the French are saying, listen, we could use a good faith agreement and go ahead here, or we can actually implement things to the letter of the law. Now, let me just take you back to the fact that MEPs were so unhappy with the way the UK had behaved here by unilaterally kind of renegotiating one of the most serious aspects of Brexit, that they'd waited until now to actually ratify the deal. So kind of taking things to as much of an impasse as they could. And there's so many loose ends that still remain about this. We do know that, as you mentioned there, the Northern Ireland Protocol is still problematic, where goods and services out of Northern Ireland and into Northern Ireland still classified technically as a part of Europe's single market. That hasn't been sorted. We know the simmering tensions that is causing in the north of Ireland. And it's essentially, as the members of the European Union have mentioned, it's a lose-lose situation for everyone. Mm-hmm. There are still heads being scratched about how comes we're here in the first place. No one can yet convince a great part of this population that this was a wise deal, unfortunately.
Right. And I mean, why did it take so long for this ratification, I mean, to take place? And what difference would it make, I mean, once it's ratified?
Well, MEPs were angry. There you are. You'd negotiated a deal after four hard years. We have spoken many times here about the toing and froing, about what British negotiators want, what Michel Barnier, who was and still remains the man helming the EU's response here, and those tensions. And then after everything was signed, said and done, Britain decided that actually we wanted some other bits sorted out that we're not a part of. These negotiations. So Europe took this personally. You know, Ursula von der Leyen, the president of the Commission here, said Europe might have to show some real teeth here, and I think we may well see what that means going forward.
Okay, we'll wait and see. Thank you very much for that. Kristen Hund, our correspondent in Paris, and we had also Amina Taylor in our London bureau joining us with our contribution. And that's it for this news review. That's a wrap for this news bulletin. Goodbye.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
U.S. President Joe Biden, in announcing an ostensible end to the U.S. war in Afghanistan, continued to pay eloquent lip service to progressive causes while maintaining the implied status quo, says Sonali Kolhatkaraplil, writer, in an article published under the heading "Dishonesty of Biden's Afghanistan Pullout Vow." Stay tuned, please, for the details of this article. President Joe Biden, in announcing an ostensible end to the U.S. war in Afghanistan, continued to pay eloquent lip service to progressive causes while maintaining the implied status quo. In a televised address from the White House on April 14th, Biden said, It's time to end America's longest war. It's time for American troops to come home. But just a day later, the New York Times reported without a hint of irony that the Pentagon, American spy agencies, and Western allies are refining plans to deploy a less visible but still potent force in the region. This means the United States is ending the war, but not really. U.S. military leaders and generals gave a much more accurate assessment of the war's future in the days following Biden's speech. Counterterrorism expert Mark Polymore Populis, a former officer of the U.S. Central Intelligence Agency, explained to the Times, "What we are really talking about are how to collect intelligence and then act against terrorist targets without any infrastructure or personnel in the country other than essentially the embassy in Kabul." In other words, the U.S. wants to wage a remotely run war against Afghanistan, as it has done in other nations such as Yemen, Syria, and Somalia. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin added 2 cents, underscoring the United States' ability to wage war without troops on the ground, saying, "There is probably not a space on the globe that the United States and its allies can't reach." Marine Corps General Kenneth McKenzie Jr. echoed this sentiment in ominous terms on April 20th at a hearing of the House of Representatives Armed Services Committee, saying, "If we are going to strike something in Afghanistan, we are going to strike it in concert with the law of armed conflict and the American way of war." One may suppose that this American way of war is unlike a traditional war where troops occupy a country, a type of war that is generally deeply unpopular with the U.S. public. By publicly promising a withdrawal of troops while quietly continuing air strikes, Biden is ensuring that U.S. violence against Afghanistan remains invisible to the American people. In other words, America's destructive involvement in Afghanistan predates by decades the post-9/11 invasion and occupation that continues to this day. Instead of owning up to the havoc the U.S. has wreaked in Afghanistan, Biden wants credit for withdrawing troops from a war his country has been involved since 1970s, not 2001, and that will most certainly not end by September 11, 2021. According to Naeem, political expert, the CIA have thousands of militias operating in Afghanistan, and there are still thousands of contractors whose objective Afghans don't even know. He summarized, "It's going to be very naive and simplistic to think that the war will end." Gaez, who has traveled to Afghanistan numerous times to oversee humanitarian aid projects, has seen firsthand what the private contractors represent. She said, "They have CIA clearance and weapons, and they can be used as a partial military force. In fact, the private military contractors outnumber U.S. troops by so much that more contractors than soldiers have died." The U.S. government's Special Inspector General for Afghanistan Reconstruction, that is SIGAR, has warned that the pullout of contractors could have worse consequences than the withdrawal of troops. The genuine aspect of Biden's speech was his insistence that the U.S. had a simple goal in Afghanistan and had met it. He said, "We went to Afghanistan in 2001 to root out Al-Qaeda, to prevent future terrorist attacks against the United States planned from Afghanistan. And that our objective was clear. But the U.S. did far more than that. It foisted its idea of democracy onto a people struggling with U.S.-backed armed warlords and thus ensured that secular democratic movements remain weak. Along the way, it killed more than 40,000 Afghan civilians, most likely an underestimate. Biden claimed that in 2001 the cause was just and I supported that military action. Then, encompassing the disastrous war into a single simplistic sentence, Biden claimed, "We delivered justice to Al-Qaeda leader Osama bin Laden a decade ago and we've stayed in Afghanistan for a decade since." With these words, the US president offered a tantalizing characterization of the Afghan war, that the US intended to root out terrorism, that the task was achieved, and that it should have left soon after. It is a comforting thought for Americans to reimagine the Afghan war through such a benevolent lens, as if U.S. people only gaffe was that they stayed too long. Biden also made absolutely no mention of the fact that bin Laden was captured and killed in Pakistan, not Afghanistan. Missing from the political dialogue over the war is just how obscenely Americans have paid to fight this futile 20-year battle. According to the Cost of War project run by Brown University, American taxpayers have thus far forked over more than $2.2 trillion for a war in Afghanistan that Biden wants Americans to believe achieved its objective by assassinating bin Laden a decade ago in Pakistan. At a time when inequality continues to rise in the United States, and politicians claim there is no money to fund infrastructure projects or a Green New Deal or Medicare for all, the cost of the Afghan war will continue to rise in both economic and human terms. Taxpayers will continue to foot the bill for airstrikes and private contractors with no end in sight. Afghans will continue to suffer and die.
سبحان الله والحمد لله لا إله إلا الله والله أكبر لا إله إلا الله.
Let's listen to the famous reciters of the Holy Quran in the month of Allah.
سبحان الله
Brother Muhammad Reza Birya, only in IRIB English Radio.
Assalamu alaikum, dear brothers and sisters in faith. In this segment of the show, The Months of Allah, we're going to talk about famous reciters of the Quran in the Muslim world. One of the greatest and most famous reciters of the Holy Quran is, without a doubt, Sheikh Muhammad Siddiq Al-Minshawi. He is very famous throughout the Muslim world. Everyone knows him, just like Sheikh Abdul Basit. Why is it that he is so famous? This reciter, who was born in 1920 in the city Minshah, and he was born into a Quranic family. Everyone was a reciter in his family. His father was a very famous reciter of the Holy Quran. Sheikh Muhammad Siddiq Minshawi memorized the whole Quran when he was a child, just like most reciters in Egypt. Sheikh Muhammad Siddiq Minshawi was asked by the Egyptian radio to come to their studio and record his recitations. But he refused their offer, just like his father, Siddiq al-Mishawi. Eventually, the radio crew brought their equipment to the place where Sheikh Muhammad Siddiq al-Mishawi was reciting, and they were able to record his voice and broadcast it on the radio. His voice had something called khashya. Khashya means a voice that has fear. But what kind of fear? Not just an ordinary fear like you're scared of someone. No. The fear is out of respect. And it's like Sheikh Muhammad Siddiq al-Minshawi was reciting the Qur'an right in front of Allah, right in front of God. When reciting the Qur'an, he wants to be careful that God is pleased with him in the way that he recites the Qur'an. And that is why we hear a kind of fear in his voice. This is other than the huzn that many reciters have in their voice. Huzn means sorrow, because, you know, the Qur'an was revealed in sorrow and it has to be recited in sorrow, as the Prophet has said. But this is beyond sorrow. This is khashya, the highest level of huzn, which is even better than huzn. With this introduction, let's go ahead and listen to the recitation of Sheikh Muhammad Siddiq al-Minshawi, verse 45 of Surah Qaf, and verses 1 to 13 of Surah Ar-Rahman.
نحن أعلم بما يقولون وما أنت عليهم بجبار
فذكر بالقرآن من يخاف وعيد الله أكبر بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الرحمن بسم
والحب ذو العصف والرأس are most knowing of what they say, and you are not over them a tyrant. But remind by the Quran whoever fears my threat. In the name of Allah, the entirely merciful, the especially merciful. The most merciful taught the Quran, created man, and taught him eloquence. The sun and the moon move by precise calculation, and the stars and trees prostrate. And the heaven he raised and imposed the balance, that you not transgress within the balance, and establish weight in justice, and do not make deficient the balance. And the earth he laid out for the creatures. Therein is fruit, and palm trees having sheaths of dates, and grain having husks, and scented plants. So which of the favors of your Lord would you deny?
Rahman, ya Rahman, sa'idni ya Rahman, ishrah sadri Qur'an, imlah qalbi Qur'an, wasqi hayati Qur'an.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The limelight. According to the American academic and political commentator Marjorie Cohn, racist violence against black people and other minorities has been part of the very fabric of the United States. Marjorie Cohn also said that the recent violent incidents involving white police officers are part of systemic racist police violence against black people in America. We're prepared for an article written by Kelly Carter Jackson. The NAFOR Assistant Professor of Humanities in the Department of Africana Studies at Wellesley College. The piece is titled, "The Derek Chauvin Verdict Won't Stop Cops Murdering Black People." The article has been published by the British newspaper The Guardian. Since May of last year, the world has been waiting for justice for George Floyd, who was killed on the streets of Minneapolis after allegedly trying to use a counterfeit $20 bill at a convenience store. The jury found police officer Derek Chauvin guilty on all counts: second-degree murder, third-degree murder, and second-degree manslaughter. It was an emotional verdict in what has been an emotional year since his killing. How are Americans to receive this moment? This verdict has been long time coming, and it's been a painful, difficult wait. Many times I have had to remind people that it was Derek Chauvin who was on trial and not George Floyd. Over and over, people questioned George Floyd's history, his drug use and his actions, anything that would shift the blame for his own death away from Derek Chauvin. As W.E.B. Du Bois, an American historian, civil rights activist, pan-Africanist, author, writer, and editor, once wrote, "Nothing in the world is easier in the United States than to accuse a black man of a crime. That is still true today. Despite all we have gone through, despite all the protests, activism, and calls for justice, we'll still see black people as criminals. Perhaps the most arduous task of the prosecution was not to prove that Derek Chauvin played a role in George Floyd's death, but to prove that George Floyd was in fact a human being. A deep-seated and pervasive culture of racism is to blame for the fact that his humanity was ever in question." As historians, the greatest opposition we can show white supremacy is to tell the truth. I have grown tired of politicians and pundits claiming that Derek Chauvin was a bad apple or an anomaly. No, the truth is, he is a mirror of white supremacy. The violence he committed was white supremacy in its purest form. For some, to mention this obvious fact is to be divisive. On Fox News Channel, Tucker Carlson issued a hateful diatribe about the trial, in which he said, "No one on CNN actually cares about George Floyd now. What they care about is you and your role in the systemic racism that supposedly killed George Floyd." Tucker Carlson said the purpose of speaking about racism is to punish you and to change America. He said that is why they are replaying that video of George Floyd dying on the sidewalk, to remind you of all that, of your culpability in his death. Tucker Carlson goes on to say that if the George Floyd Derek Chauvin trial ends up in acquittal, there could be riots. We accept that as a fact of life in this country. No civilized country should accept that, but suddenly we do. Apparently, Carlson thinks a civilized country should accept black Americans being killed in broad daylight by police officers. Much as Tucker Carlson and his ilk would like us to keep silent about white supremacy, we cannot and we will not. Since this trial began, three people a day have been killed by the police. Over half of these victims are black and Latino people. We will repeat it over and over and over again until black people stop being murdered in the streets by police officers. This is the audacity of white supremacy, that a white police officer could, in broad daylight, while being recorded among a gathering of witnesses, kneel on a black man's neck until he dies. He kneeled despite the fact that George Floyd told him he couldn't breathe, and he kept kneeling despite the fact that Floyd told him he was going to die. In this country, a black athlete like Colin Kaepernick can't peacefully kneel on the ground in protest without backlash. Yet, a white police officer can kneel on a black man's neck until he dies. The verdict doesn't take away from that fact. It's hard to know if Derek Chauvin ever recognized George Floyd's humanity. That's what made the weeks of questions and cross-examination of witnesses that took place so gruelingly to watch. I watched Derek Chauvin's body language throughout the trial. He always appeared indifferent. What notes was he taking? What, if any, testimony moved him to feel empathy? In the 9 minutes 29 seconds that Derek Chauvin's knee was on George Floyd's neck, all I saw was defiance on his part. He was a belligerent cop who was not going to be told how to do his job. Derek Chauvin never exhibited remorse. But even if he did, remorse does nothing to further justice. Rendering George Floyd's death as a series of unfortunate events does nothing to alter violent outcomes for black people. Make no mistake, a conviction for Derek Chauvin is not equivalent to a vaccine that will protect us from death and injury. A prison sentence will not protect black people from the violence of the police. Black men, women and children are still being killed by the police. There are no winners in this outcome. An acquittal is not justice. A conviction is not justice. In America, we have never seen justice because justice is a system that fully recognizes black humanity. And we are far from a justice system like that. The stakes of white supremacy do not start or even end with this verdict. George Floyd's family will never recover his life, his love or laughter. Black Americans will not cease to be seen as threats, and Derek Chauvin will walk away as the exception rather than the rule. Racist violence against black people and other minorities has been part of the very fabric of the United States. Recent violent incidents involving white police officers are part of a systemic racist police violence against black people in America. Marjorie Cohn, who is a professor emeritus at the Thomas Jefferson School of Law in San Diego, California, and also a former president of the National Lawyers Guild, made the remarks in an online interview recently. From the day witnesses began to testify in the Derek Chauvin trial on 29th of March through to 18th of April, at least 64 people in the United States died at the hands of law enforcement. More than half of those victims were black and brown. During the trial, 20-year-old Duente White was shot and killed by a police officer very close to the courthouse where Derek Chauvin was being tried. The police officer claimed she was reaching for her taser, but grabbed her gun instead. Even if she had used the taser, that would have constituted a use of excessive force. These are not isolated occurrences, but rather part of systemic racist police violence against black people in the United States. The new US President Joe Biden is claiming that he supports police reform and supposedly is a vast improvement over his predecessor, Donald Trump, but he cautioned don't expect him to propose real systemic change, including defunding and abolition of the police. The United States was established in the wake of a long history of slavery and committed genocide on the indigenous population of the United States. From the slave codes to the black codes, racist violence has been part of the very fabric of this country. Jim Crow laws, which followed Reconstruction, kept African Americans oppressed. That legacy is embodied in today's policing, which is steeped in systemic and racist violence.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or BAT 5, and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Forty recommendations by Imam Khamenei for the journey towards God. Internal obstacles. The path ahead is clear for us, and the obstacles are also clear for the Iranian nation. You must overcome these obstacles, both the internal obstacles and the external ones. The internal obstacles can be overcome by supplication to God, prayer, attention to God, self-edification, and reinforcing morals. If our hearts are not purified, we will not be able to build a correct world. If we are defective inside, we cannot fix a defective society and a defective world. The Iranian nation has a great responsibility that has to be fulfilled. They have to build a wonderful world both for themselves and for other societies. You can do it. but only if each and every one of us works on self-edification. Praying attentively, reciting Quran, prayer and supplication, fasting in Ramadan, and night prayers, especially for the youth who are more receptive, can be self-edifying.
فيك الحب زاد عم العباد يا خير زاد رمضان يا شهر القرآن فيك أذوق حلاوة الإيمان لا لا تنقضي أنت للروح دواء رمضان
One hour in seclusion. Pray. Stand up the night in prayers. Contemplate. Be attentive by dhikr. Spend an hour between yourself and God. Put different occupations aside and get closer to God, God's friend, and Imam al-Mahdi, God hasten his reappearance. Get closer to Quran and reflect on it. Mosque as a base. Establish brotherly ties with the Imam of your mosque, the worshippers at the mosque, and the believers who visit the mosque, and safeguard and fortify those ties. Stand up in prayer at the earliest time, in congregation, in any mosque you find yourself in. Attend religious gatherings at mosques. Attend Quran and dua recitation sessions. Make mosques more attractive.
Alhamdulillah, alhamdulillah. All praises to Allah, all praises to Allah. Alhamdulillah, alhamdulillah. All praises to Allah, all praises to Allah.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.